The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Problem Gambling Podcast. I'm Barry Grant, an addiction counsellor with Extern Problem Gambling. And my co-host is Tony O'Reilly, also an addiction counsellor with The Project and the co-author of the book Tony 10. And today, we're delighted to have as our guests Ryan Pitcher and Chris Gillam from the brilliant All Better Off podcast, which is a UK podcast, but I have no doubt you guys have listeners all over the world. And you guys were a big inspiration for us starting off this podcast, because I've been following what you guys were doing on Twitter, and it was early days of the first lockdowns, I think, and things went a little bit quiet. There was a weird time there, the calm before the storm for us in our project, both on the helpline and on the counselling front, where nobody knew what was going to happen next. So everything just went, it was like tumbleweed time. And myself and Tony were going, okay, we need to do something else here and find different ways of connecting with people. And I suppose creating, I suppose, a resource, I think, which is something I think we've learned with the podcast, that people will contact us out of the blue and say, oh, I started listening to the podcast, and because of that, now I rang the helpline, or it's really helped me in my recovery. And we never hear from them again after that, because it's helping in some ways. So you end up with this big, I suppose, library of content that people can dip in and out of today, or in a year's time, or in 5 years' time. And hopefully all of this stuff helps one person or one more person. So thanks a million for joining us today. Ryan, I might start with you. I mean, do you want to tell us a little bit about your own lived experience with gambling?
Sure. Thanks for having us on, first and foremost. So I started gambling when I was around 16 years old. It began responsibly, by all accounts, football betting and such. I had a few issues when I was younger. I got kicked out of home and found myself on the streets. And only upon reflection, as I came into recovery last year, you know, I started thinking about where things may have gone a little bit awry for me in my adulthood. And I just remember one day, 17 years of age, in the bookmakers, which was my regular jaunt, so to speak, and I saw someone playing the fixed odds betting terminal, see a bundle of cash that they managed to obtain from the counter. And from that moment, I started playing the fixed odds betting terminals, and I was hooked. And then it just became just, I couldn't stop. I'd go in and play the fixed odds betting terminals. I was playing the virtuals. I was doing the football. If there was a snail race, I was on it. I just couldn't stop myself. And this progressed over 15 years, going online and doing a wholesale damage. When the fixed odds betting terminal stake reduction happened a couple of years ago, I turned to online slots, which I'd never really played before. It wasn't something that really tickled my fancy out of everything, and I decided to go play there. And I've described it before on the podcast. That caused me a whole new level of harm, because psychologically, even with the fixed odds betting terminals, I could get to a certain point, maybe £1,800, £2,000 down, and I go, oh, I need a bit of a miracle now to get out of a hole. And whereas with online slots, I only ever needed one more bonus. So it didn't really matter how deep the hole got. I just continued and continued. So the level of harm, certainly financially, and I would say psychologically as well, even in recovery, I've struggled to get over that addiction to online slots. I remember having a lot of dreams about it very early on in my recovery. Again, another episode that we covered on the podcast was around slot addiction. And, I revealed that I was actually watching streams in my recovery, which, by the way, we don't advocate for, but it was something that we discussed with Luke Clark from the University of British Columbia over in Canada, and which was quite interesting. But within those 15 years, there was a lot of things, obviously, that I did. I stole a six-figure sum from a family member. So, yeah, at the start of the first lockdown, I was essentially pushed into recovery once it got discovered what I'd actually done. And, yeah, I had three options, and that was to either embrace this journey of recovery or alternatively, I'd had really... suffered with really bad mental health issues, suicidal thoughts and such. And that was obviously an option as well for me, or it was prison. And fortunately, I chose the former and ended up recovery and found loads of amazing people, including Chris.
And sorry, how did you come into contact with Chris, Ryan?
So I created a pseudonym on Twitter to try and I was called at Ruined Gambler. I don't know why I called myself that at the time, but I was wholly anonymous. And I just wanted to find people that sort of understood me and maybe had experienced something similar. And so I just signed up last March. And I started blogging just to almost get things off of my chest. I wrote some articles on a personal blog. I just wanted to be honest and get it all out there. And that's where I met Chris, Kishan, Kelly Fields, and a bunch of other people, you know, the whole community, Tony Parenti, et cetera, James and whatnot, and started following Tony, obviously. And very quickly immersed myself with these people. And it was just a community. They understood me. It was the first time I felt understood, and that was really, really important. And Chris was a great help in terms of signposting me early on, giving me practical advice and you know, about just living an honest day every day. And that is my philosophy that I've taken into my recovery.
Yeah, and there's that great fellowship on different social media platforms. I think it's probably, if I'm honest, it's probably stronger in the UK than it is in Ireland. There was the Hazelden model. I'm gonna my minor tangent here. There's the Hazelden model of addiction treatment, which is comes from the Minnesota model, and I think they came to Ireland in the 70s or 80s to try and bring the Hazelden model of treatment to Ireland. And when they went back to Minnesota and they reported on their findings in Ireland, they said Irish people are too secretive. This kind of post-colonial mindset that everybody's out to get you, you know. So that maybe that's part of it, and we blame a lot of stuff on that kind of post-colonial mindset in Ireland, unfortunately. But I think maybe there's a thing, and obviously the population is much bigger in the UK, so there's greater anonymity in the UK. There's very few degrees of separation in Ireland. Everybody kind of knows everybody almost personally, or there's very few degrees of separation. So I think definitely maybe Tony, you might disagree with me here, but I think from my perspective, looking at it, there's a stronger fellowship online, stronger community online. Some people remain anonymous, which of course is absolutely fine. Some people use their real names, but I think there's a huge amount of support there that can be derived from that. I mean, you said a lot of really, really interesting things there, Ryan. I mean, the FOBTs is something we've spoken to a lot of guests from the UK. The FOBTs is something that just keeps coming up. And in Ireland, there's this kind of weird gentleman's agreement between the bookmakers that they never had them, even though the exact same bookmaking chains happily had them in the UK and made absolute fortunes off a lot of people's pain and suffering, you know. And then there was great campaigns went on and the stake restrictions were brought in. And it's interesting that your experience then, once they restricted the stakes, it was switching to something like online slots, where of course there are no limits, or if you're playing online roulette, no limits. And, you know, that knowledge, that kind of insight, in a way that with the FOBTs, if you're hitting 1800 and losses, you kind of, there was a realization, okay, this is, I'm not going to turn this around. But with slots, I mean, some of the jackpots on slots, the daily jackpots or some of these kind of mega jackpots will be vastly in excess of £1,800. There would be astronomical sums, and most people have had big wins at some point, which of course we all know feed the addiction. And Stacey, who we had on last week, spoke very eloquently about that. But that thing of being pushed into recovery, like, a lot of people make the assumption that you have to be 100% motivated yourself and volunteering for recovery. In my experience as a counselor, Tony, I'm sure you've seen this, and I'm sure yourself, Ryan and Chris, have seen this as well. Not everybody is 100% personally motivated to get into recovery. A lot of people have virtual guns to their heads, are doing it on the back of some major ultimatums or being kicked out of the family home, whatever it might be. And sometimes, quite often, the motivation comes later. You know, the card comes after, before the horse, or vice versa. So being pushed into recovery isn't always necessarily a bad thing. You know, in the early stages, quite often people are resistant to that. But some, you know, you look back on it a year later, 2 years later, 5 years later, it could be the best thing that ever happened to you. Watching the streams in recovery, I've come across that with quite a few people over the years. It's an interesting one. That is a really interesting one. I mean, when you discussed that in your podcast, what did you land on? I'd be interested to know.
Yeah, I mean, one of the guests that I had on for that particular episode, Scott, a gentleman from Derbyshire, he also had used streams for 3 years. and for me, obviously, it's not part of a recovery process because the monkey's always on your back. However, for us, I wouldn't say it worked because I don't think you're necessarily fully into recovery if that's what you're doing, if that makes sense. Obviously, having someone who's researched this in Dr. Luke Clark, and obviously really good at what he does in psychology and whatnot, just to give us a bit of insight into how we were feeling, why we were doing it, and so forth, I felt really balanced the episode. Since then, I'm pleased to report both myself and Scott, you know, I've kept in contact with. In fact, I'm due to be meeting up with him later on in the year for a night out. We've both stopped doing that some time ago. This was last year when we recorded, and you know, so certainly not this year. We haven't been using these streams. I have seen through that there are people that do it. And Luke himself said there needs to be more research in this particular space. There was a recent article that he was a part of, which I found fascinating when he did touch upon this particular subject. Following that episode, there were people that reached out to me basically saying, I do the same and I want to stop. And, you know, people are crying out to stop using it. I'm not here to judge, and like none of us are. And as far as I'm concerned, if people aren't gambling, you know, that's obviously a positive step. However, people do need to move away from that sort of, I guess it's a source of medication. I guess, for example, a drug user or methadone, for example. Yeah. And I guess that's how I would consider it. But it's something that obviously we wouldn't suggest.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I've heard rumors, again, I don't know if these can be substantiated, that some of the people who do kind of Twitch streams of themselves gambling, let's say it's slots or other kind of online gambling activities or YouTube streams, are sponsored by the gambling company. They're given huge stakes, which they can then go on to you know, place massive stakes. You know, when they have wins, they will have massive wins. And in some cases, it may give a very, very skewed and unrealistic picture for some of the people who are watching them, which may be younger people who are in early stages of experimenting with gambling, or people in recovery, or people who are actively gambling and active addiction. Did that come up, or is that something that you would factor in?
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with what you say there. And again, to try and balance that that episode up, we actually had a streamer come on to talk about the activities and in terms of safer gambling and what they do when people reach out to them saying, look, we need help. I think alarmingly, when I was historically watching these streams is, and this is something that we will be, and I know we're going to probably talk about it today, the next week's Sustainable Gambling Conference that we are going to be mentioning. There's a few points here. A lot of the time the streams aren't age-gated at all, both on Twitch and YouTube. We've seen, I've seen streamers when I was doing that who were pushing unregulated cryptocurrency websites. And a lot of the time is you're right in terms of the unrealistic gameplay. Some of them are sponsored, it's not real money, etc. And it does bring that sort of falseness around the gameplay, but also in terms of the markets as well. Obviously, the UK Gambling Commission have restricted slots in over here, so a lot of them are moving to foreign territories, yet their main market is still the UK, and that's where the majority of watchers viewers of these streamers are going to be. And so they're not getting a true reflection of gameplay, for those that can gamble responsibly.
Yeah, it's a bit of a minefield. Right?
It's a wild west. I've described it as a wild west. It really is. And it's something that, given my experiences in online slots, both in active addiction and even in recovery, as we've discussed today, it's something that, I'm bringing to the attention of those in high command at certain operators. And in fact, I don't want to mention any names. I have liaised with certain operators and made them aware of bad practice around this. And some of them have actually acted. So I think credit where credit is due, as in they've actually basically said to the streamers, we don't want you advertising our casinos anymore because of, what I've pointed out to them. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And I think some operators are more inclined to do that than others. And yeah, I think it is important to give credit to the ones who do that and do make an effort. There is a healthy dollop of cynicism about some of them just wanting to be one step ahead of any future regulation. That may be part of the picture as well. They're commercial entities. We all know how this thing works, and we're not here to kind of bash the gambling industry more than is required. Right? But yeah, ultimately, this is a show similarly to your own, where we're just trying to create conversations and information that will help somebody who's either in active addiction or early stage recovery or long-term recovery, that's going to be of some benefit to them. And I suppose spending all day bashing the gambling industry doesn't really achieve that in any meaningful way. Tony's gone off there for a second. Oh, Tony, you're back. Tony, any thoughts there, questions for Ryan before we move on to Chris?
I suppose just to pick up what you're saying around being pushed into recovery, I think that was a very, very important point to make, because similar to myself, there was an event that happened that, you had to go in. Well, I didn't have to go in. I knew that I needed to go in, but there was still a part of me was just thinking I was just a little bit unlucky. Now, reflecting back now, you can kind of say, well, it was more than that, but there is a certain sometimes there is that resistance to change, or resistance to, or even fear to change. And I think it's very important, I suppose, for anyone listening, or is that it doesn't matter how you get into support. And even if you are a little bit resistant to it, the most important thing is that you're engaging in it. And sometimes people might engage in it and just kind of feel they can always go back. It's not this, if I don't get it the first time, I'm gooshed, to use an Irish word. But I think for me, I was forced and I had to go in. Like I was thinking, I have to go in for court case reasons. And it was about 6 weeks. I was, in there, as Barry was saying about the Irish, I was there, everyone's out to get me. I can't say anything about what there's reporters in the GA meetings. Like, and I was so paranoid around it. But also then it was after about 5 or 6 weeks, and I said, sure, I'm going to be here for another 6 weeks. I might as well just throw myself into it. And that's when it really changed. So even though I was slightly resistant, I maybe didn't want to be there because I missed my daughter's first birthday, I missed weddings, I missed friends' events, but I knew I had to be there, but I didn't want to be there. But then something did change within me while I was in there. So I think that was a very, very important point to make. And it's interesting about the streams, as I said here on the podcast a few weeks ago, I was messing with the telly, trying to get live score just to see what the app was like on the telly, just for research purposes, for the podcast, and I came across it, Twitch screen. I just went in to have a look at it, and I was kind of like, my jaw was just dropping watching the comments, watching how the person was describing the play. I could see how it could be triggering for people in recovery, or people, it could give it this false sense, very much like the Cam Adair video about the Grand Theft Auto casino that he done on YouTube. It gives a different kind of view on what gambling can be like, you know, the big wins. It kind of normalizes it a little bit, that these big wins are what you should expect, where that might not always be the case. Because if the fella that was on, I was watching, I don't know who he was or what he was doing, but he had it on auto spin. He was talking while the thing was, and you could see the money going down. Then it hit this big thing and the money would fly up. So say a lot of people were kind of focusing on, oh, look, he's after winning a huge amount of money, but the money was after, like, it was talking tens of thousands. I don't know whether it was real money, virtual money. I don't know what it was. I was just, for 5 minutes, I was just transfixed with it. And then I shouldn't be in here. I'm very similar, even in my own, in the latter stages of my addiction, I would have watched a lot of the poker on telly. And it was, even in active addiction, there was something soothing about it, because when I had no money, it was just like, I think you were still getting the same kind of butterflies or feels in the stomach when someone would hit a hand. So it was, you were relating to the person, and then you get connected with a character or a player within it. So yeah, there's loads of, and it's something I don't do now, but there is, for me, it was a way of nearly escaping from the stress that I was under at that time, a bit of escapism. So maybe that's part of, you know, part of your recovery. You just need to escape into something that was, I don't know, just, I don't want to get too much into the psychodynamic or psychobabble of it, but the big thing, I suppose, for me was we would hear a lot as well of people, when they lose the money, they would go on and play the free games as well. So it's kind of that kind of continuing the gameplay, even though there's no money involved. Probably gone off a little bit off topic there a bit, but the one point I really did want to pick up on was the reluctance to go in. But then, you know, you look at you now in really good recovery. So even if it's a little bit hard at the start, it's just sticking it out and being open to the process, and then recovery can come.
I think it's the discovery aspect, to be honest. I mean, you know, as Barry was saying earlier on, you know, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, I've been in recovery 18 months now, and to me, it's a journey of discovery. And, you know, what we're discussing with regards to the slot streams, etc., it was about finding my way. And, you know, I've found it perhaps in a bit of an unorthodox way, perhaps, but that's perfectly fine. You know, I'm very proud of my last bet date being last March, and, you know, we move forward, and it's just a constant discovery. And, you know, and this is why I needed the community, people like Chris. And yeah, I spoke to Chris about it very early on. Obviously, he advised me not to and stuff like that, and rightly so. But this is why the community is so great. I can lean on people and I can discuss my problems and such. And I wouldn't change it for the world. You know, we live and learn, and I'm in a much happier place now than when I was when I came into recovery last March, against, you know, my better judgment, against my will. But yeah, everything happens for a reason, and I'm much more happier now. So yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. There can be unorthodox phase of recovery, and there isn't one form of therapy will kind of cover everyone. Like, some people will kind of be drawn more towards CBT or person-centered or motivational interview. And as I always say, and probably at the risk of repeating it again, if your recovery is standing on your head for 2 hours a day, who am I to say that's right or wrong? Once you're not doing the exact thing that that brought you into addiction in the first place. But then, as you said, you were able to notice that, you know, the awareness is key, and you're to notice that maybe I need to change this behavior too. And that's key, because recovery isn't linear. It's kind of this thing we have to work on. There's ups and downs, ins and outs. And like, even 10 years into recovery now, I'm still tweaking bits and pieces around control of money at times, around things that I'm doing, especially around online shopping. I've mentioned on the podcast a lot. I have to really look at that, because there are old behaviors coming in. So I think, you know, recovery is a journey, and it's a, you know, it's not one that's plain sailing. It's, as I said, it's ups and downs. So we have to really move and go and grow and learn from things we've done that work, things that we've done that haven't worked, and then just keep on traveling through that continuum into new way of living.
Well said, sir. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I'd often say the same thing, that if your version of recovery is hugging a tree or like that, standing on your head or whatever it is, whatever works for you, right, is the thing that works for you. There's no one size fits all. I wish there were. That would be great. And quite often cognitive behavioral therapy is seen as that thing because there's a lot of research into it, and there's, you know, a so-called evidence base, which in psychology, you know, you're kind of, you're pushing the you're stretching the term evidence base a little bit, anything to do with psychology. But, you know, one size fits all, absolutely, positively, there's no such thing. And just find the thing that works for you. And I suppose just to put a bit of an asterisk or a health warning beside the streaming thing, that for some people, that could be a trigger to relapse. And some of it is misleading, as we have discussed. But like, who are we to say what works and what doesn't work for everybody? Chris, you've been very, very, very patient there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your own experience of gambling?
Yeah, absolutely, Barry. I'd love to. So differently to Ryan, like my 15 year, or ended up being 20 year, addiction was with alcohol first and foremost. So it's 15 years through an alcohol addiction, which I didn't realize I had all the time. I didn't understand this dependence, and it wasn't working for me anymore. You know, like, I was using the alcohol to change the way I felt. I was very fearful, didn't realize that. Actually, I'm currently in about 3 weeks' time, I've got a session with a psychiatrist to have an ADHD assessment. And looking back, I feel like I used alcohol to cover all this kind of stuff up, to help me get through the day, self-medicating. By the time I got to 30, I was still using that alcohol, more and more and more of it, but I wasn't feeling any different. And that's when I accidentally stumbled across gambling, to be honest, because gambling was nothing I'd done before. I'd never done it. I hadn't enjoyed it. All right, I'd put the lottery on a few times, you know, I'd done that. But other than that, that was it. I never did anything as a kid. When I went to the beach with the parents, you know, my brother'd go in and play on the 2p machines. I didn't want to do that. I'd stand outside with my mum and have an ice cream because I found it boring. And as I grew up, it was boring. Although, in fact, I just remembered that when I got married and I was 23, when I had had two stag do's, one of them was like a family stag do. And we went to the dogs. I thought, oh, what can everybody do? We went to the dogs. I sat in the restaurant. I don't even know if I placed a bet. If I did, it would have been like a quid on inside. I don't even know. I didn't go there for that. And that was when I was 23. So that was 7 years before I then found gambling. And it was, like I say, it was through me feeling kind of vulnerable and down and not knowing what to do. And then seeing a lot of adverts on the TV, which were kind of saying, this is something fun to do. So I wasn't doing it in a way to hurt myself, just thought, oh, what can I do? What can I do? Which might be fun. And that was it. It was perceived, you know, it just said, this is a fun thing to do. Come and enjoy this. Do it with your friends. Have a load of fun. Do it with your friends. But actually just download it on your phone and do it on your own, which is what I did. And I know Brian just said, like, his gambling was responsible for a while until it became problematic. Mine was, I downloaded an app to place a bet on a football game, and within weeks I was betting on everything, locking myself in the office at work, betting on horse races, watching horse races when I should have been working, when I've never watched a horse race in my life before, betting on virtual dog races in between, betting on everything, being cross-sold products, being on the online casino, doing this 24 hours a day while drinking at the same time. And my life became unmanageable incredibly quickly from that point. And so the gambling only lasted for 5 years, but it wasn't constant for 5 years. It was kind of up and down and binges. And I managed to do it for a while. And I'd get to a place where, this is horrendous, I've lost everything. Go to my mum and dad. I didn't know I was going to do this. I'm so sorry. What's going on? And tell my wife, and everyone be in tears. And it's like, right, I'll stop now, because I didn't mean to do it. And obviously everybody tried to help me. I didn't stop because I couldn't stop. I stopped for a little while and it came back, because I was never dealing with myself. You know, I was never dealing with the emotional issues and all that kind of stuff. So that happened for about 2.5 years. And I went to the Problem Gambling Clinic in London, which was a fantastic opportunity for me. Now, it really, really was. You know, they dealt with CBT and had group sessions. And then after the weekly group sessions, there was like a monthly session where you could go and catch up, which I never went to because I didn't think I had a problem. Of the 12 CBT sessions, I probably went to 8. A couple of them, I just stayed in the pub and I never made it there. And the reason was, really, I needed my family to know that I was trying to stop this gambling because it was causing an issue for everybody, as it does. You know, this addiction, which is so indiscriminate, just hurts so many people as well. And I wanted them to know that I was trying to do something about it. My problem was I hated gambling. I was scared of gambling. I could see what it was doing to me. I've described it before as being in the ring as a boxer and doing 11 rounds of just the alcohol. And then the last round, I put the gambling in, it gives me the knockout blow. Now, the problem was I still wanted that alcohol because I didn't know how to live without it. So I'd had it for so long. I was scared to stop. I wanted to get rid of the gambling. And for a little while I did, but then I did a raffle at a school fete. I got all the same feelings back. I knew I shouldn't have done that raffle because I'd learned it at the problem gambling clinic. They said, that's a bad idea. I did it. The feelings came back. I buried those feelings. Didn't tell anybody that I shouldn't have done it. I won the first prize, obviously, because that would be the only time I'd have won the first prize. It wouldn't happen again, I'm sure, but there we go. And then I was back gambling again in a year that should have been great for me because, you know, I was getting work done in the house. I'd remortgaged, not for gambling reasons. I'd remortgaged to get the house sorted for the family. I couldn't handle being in a good situation. I'd got through the difficulties from 2015 when I'd been to the problem gambling clinic. And because I hadn't stopped drinking, I started gambling again. I really needed to stop both. And 2017 was a horrendous year for me, absolutely horrendous. A year which should have been fantastic, getting all the house done. I was out of all of my debt to banks and credit cards. Don't get me wrong, the debt to my dad was huge. And it still is. And I'm going to be paying my dad back. I hope he lives long enough. He probably listens to this. I hope you live long enough, Dad, to get that money back. I'm certainly going to try and get it all back to you. But it's terrible, you know. But I was able to get that remortgage because it looked like I'd paid off all of the debts. I was in a great place. I couldn't handle it. And one of the things I noticed was I used gambling as self-harm as well. So when I felt that I didn't deserve something, and I've noticed this now where I've been looking at a lot of the ADHD stuff, I have very low self-worth and stuff like that, and I have very little confidence with my work and stuff like that, and I felt like I needed to harm myself. And the interesting thing is, Ryan mentioned something earlier about kind of losing money and getting a bit back and getting back to even, I think he might have said, and he also spoke about the FOB tease. You know, you see you've got to 1,800 down, you need to stop it. But online, you can win loads of money back. It can just come back. You can get a big bonus on the slots. I mean, I remember one night playing double ball roulette. What a stupid game. You know, you got to get two balls into the same number. But I was desperate to get my money back. And I did. I'd sat there for ages and all my money had gone. Nearly all of it had gone. And then two balls rolled into number two. I couldn't believe it. I've got the feeling back now. It's just relief. It's just total relief. So I spun it again and two balls went into number two. And I was just like, I can't believe this. How's that happened twice? But do you know what I realized looking back now? I was relieved because I got the money back, not to put back in the bank and pay off my debts or anything like that. I was relieved that I had that money back to do it again. So I could keep escaping. So I could keep that feeling of I can escape all the difficulties in my life. I don't have to talk to anyone about it. I could just get back to this casino. So I stopped playing the double ball roulette and I went on to normal roulette because that seemed like a lot more sensible thing for me to do, and back on the slot machines and all this stuff. But yeah, for me, it was a different story to Ryan. I was 30. I only gambled till I was 35. That's when I went to GA. So it was 2.5 years after the problem gambling clinic. And there was one night, the last episode was horrendous. I was sitting there planning to take my life. My plan was, and I remember this so, so vividly, in that last year in 2017, a lot of it's a blur. I was on medication. I was off work. You know, I was in a terrible place being depressed. But the one thing I remember was looking at my pension and thinking, if I in my own life, does my wife get this money? Do the kids get the money? Because they don't need me, but they need to be able to survive. So I decided I was going to try and win the money. So essentially, I was playing to win the money, but I wasn't playing to win the money. I was really playing to die because I knew that once I got that money, I could hit withdraw and I could end my life before I could then hit reverse withdrawal, because that had happened before. And earlier in the year, I had done exactly that. I hadn't made as much money as I wanted to make on this occasion, but I'd won a super life-changing amount. And because I knew that my family knew I shouldn't have been gambling, I reversed that withdrawal. And that played in my head, that stayed there. So I knew I can do this. It could happen. It can happen again. And I'm very fortunate on that last night that I lost it all. I lost everything. And I sat there and I thought, right, I've now got a decision to make. I end my life like I planned to, but the plan was to have this money for the family to live. I don't have that. So it's that or I recover. And I chose recovery, thank God. But the plan was actually for the next day. So the 29th of October 2017 was the last time I gambled. The last time I drank was on the 30th of October of 2017. But that was only one pint. And that's because I went out at lunchtime with my wife and the kids, had one pint with the plan of going out that night with one of my friends to get absolutely annihilated and then come back the next morning and tell my wife it's all happened again, but this time I'm going to find recovery properly and I'm not going to gamble and also I'm not going to drink because I have to do both. But she found me out. She found me out before I went out that night, and that ate away at me for a little while, actually. For about the first year that I was going to AA, I was like, I can't believe I had one pint on the last day. One pint. How pathetic is that one pint of Cronenberg? And that really played on my mind. It's gone now, because what I realise now is, thank God she realised, because would I have returned that night? Maybe, maybe not. Would I have told her the next morning? Maybe or maybe not. Would I have somehow found money again to get back into the gambling? All these things could have happened. So I'm so thankful that she found out. But it was then, you know, so that would have been on the Monday morning she found out. And on that Thursday night, I was at my first Gamblers Anonymous meeting. That Friday night, I was at my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I haven't looked back since. I've loved it. Gave me a little bit of hope, just walking in and seeing people who I could relate to. And I hadn't had that before. I mean, let's be fair, actually, I did have that at the problem gambling clinic. There was a bunch of about 12 people there. I wasn't ready to admit that I was like them. But this time I wasn't there being pushed. I was there because maybe my family would tell you differently, but certainly I feel that I was there because I was ready to be there. And in fact, I think they would say that because I remember that night, that Monday night, we went to my mum and dad's. I had to tell them all again. I mean, I'll never forget that night. My dad had obviously knew a few times before, but that night he was just totally speechless and he just walked away from me and I didn't know what to say, and it looked like the end of his world. Whereas the times before it had been much more pragmatic, but this particular time I remember sitting there and my mum said something like, he looks different this time, it's different. And I think she knew that I meant it when I was going to get the help for both. I'd never admitted the alcohol problem before. And until I admitted both, I couldn't really recover. And I honestly believe that. What a beautiful night that Thursday night was. I met people just like me I could talk to, who I'm still friends with now. New people come all the time, of course. But for me, and like you guys all said, there are different ways to recover. And I totally get that. And that's one of the things that I have learned in the last kind of 18 months since meeting Ryan and starting this podcast. Because I was very much, GA has worked for me, so let's do GA. GA is a great way. Now, GA is great. It's absolutely brilliant. I go every Thursday. I love it. Is today Thursday? No, today's Wednesday. So I'll be going tomorrow. It's brilliant because I get to go and I get to talk to people. I get to have a community. I get to talk to people who understand and they can talk to me and teach me lessons. But, you know, that isn't the only place you can go to do that. That's why the Twitter community that we're part of is so amazing, because it offers exactly the same. It actually does. And for me, yeah, it's always been about just being able to explain who I am and how I feel. And that's something I couldn't do before recovery. And as recovery went on, after about a year and a half to 2 years, I started to do some blogging. I thought, I need something more. And that was blogging. And then when Ryan came to me and said about doing the podcast, the time was right for that, because I'd let my work know by this point. I could be honest. That was the only thing in the first couple of years of my recovery. I hadn't told my work because I was worried what they think. And I understand and respect that some people feel they can't tell their work, and maybe they can't. But my life, it's the best thing I've ever done, to be totally open and honest with everybody. And it's opened up so many opportunities. I'm so thankful for it. And hey, do you know what? I love who I am today. And I wouldn't be me without having gone through this journey. And it's tough. It's tough at the moment. Like I said, I've got this ADHD assessment in a few weeks' time. I am struggling some days, unbelievably. But you know what? I'm struggling without gambling or drinking. Imagine how terrible it would be with that. Instead, I can think about what's going on and make good decisions. And sometimes I have to accept that days are going to be very difficult, and they'll be difficult all day long, and they might not get better. And the next day might be better, or it might not be. But that's all right. It'll pass. But the times I'm living in now are the times where I would have been drinking or gambling so that I didn't feel the feelings I'm feeling now. How much better is it that I can just chat to people and talk to them about it and get the help and advice that I need? You know, recovery is a beautiful thing. And I wouldn't have it. Do you know what? I wouldn't have it if I hadn't been through the addictions.
Oh man, you said so many beautiful things there. It's hard to know where to start. Thanks, Chris. I mean, that thing of being able to just feel the feelings, you know, Tony Adams' old thing, which I think is, I don't think he came up with it. I think this is an old 12-step chestnut. That the best thing about recovery is that you get all your feelings back. And the worst thing about recovery is you get all your feelings back. And I suppose the upside is that you learn, or you have to learn, at sink or swim, how do I deal with strong feelings without resorting to alcohol, gambling, drugs, whatever the addiction of choice is, or combination of addictions. And the ADHD, certainly I've seen that, Tony, you might have seen this with quite a few people as well over the years, that a lot of people, certainly around gambling, ADHD can be a feature. I think it's a really effective way of focusing your attention on something. So many things going on, you know, you guys may notice already, gambling was never a feature of my life. I've never really had any interest in it, but I've experimented with it and opened up online gambling accounts. And it's so overwhelming. There's so many different things going on. It's so like, oh, well, that bet's going down, but no, hang on, I cut back that. And oh, hang on, look at the tennis over here. And there's this and this. Oh, look at all this stuff. And oh, there's a roulette wheel. And you know, like, if you're a bit like me with a low tolerance for boredom, it's like, ooh, there's lots of interesting. I'm bored with this, but look at, there's a million other things going on here. And maybe for some people with ADHD, that can be a feature as well. So I completely get that. I mean, you described gambling as a way of self-harming. I think for some people, with alcohol misuse or abuse or whatever name you want to put on it, that can be an element of it as well. But I think you described it beautifully there, that the first 11 rounds of beating the shit out of yourself were the drink, and then then you draft in tag team in Mike Tyson for the last round, which is the gambling, and it's like boom on your, you know, that's it, game over, pal. And I think that it can be that way for a lot of people as well, because okay, alcohol can do terrible, terrible things to a person's body and their lives and the lives of their families and so on. But it tends to do it over a longer timeline, whereas gambling, you can really go off the rails fast. You know, if that's the goal, is to kind of hit the self-destruct button, it's a pretty quick and effective way of doing it with gambling as well. So I love the way you described that. And, you know, the reverse withdrawals thing, I mean, that's, have most of the gambling operators, did the Gambling Commission ban that in the UK? It's hard to keep track of all these things. Is it still a thing?
I know it's changing. I think Ryan might correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's October this year they're supposed to make sure they're not doing it by. But certainly I know some operators at least have definitely stopped doing it from our conversations. I mean, it was so dangerous. It was a horrendous thing. And I don't think they realise the harm it does on you mentally going forward. Because like I said, I don't think I'd have been sitting there that last night thinking this is achievable to win this money unless I'd done it before. But actually, if I'd have removed, I sometimes think back and think, do you know what? I shouldn't have been gambling at that point when I won that huge figure. If I'd have taken that out and had to confess at that point, my family would have known I had a problem. And I might have been one of those people forced into recovery then, except I'd have been forced into recovery having taken out those winnings. And the gambling was never about winnings for me. But what it would have done was avoided me getting to that place down the line where I was so desperate with no other way out other than to end my life, but knowing that actually it's possible to win money. And this is the crazy thing about the gambling industry, isn't it? Nobody wins in the long term. But if you're somebody who isn't like me, who isn't a compulsive gambler, who can switch off, you know, maybe you can bet a few quid, be very lucky and win a load of money and never come back. I can't. So every time I win money, I'm going to go back for more. Every time I lose money, I'm going to go back for more. So, you know, if I hadn't reversed that withdrawal and have had to confess to my family, would it have saved 6 months of agony? It might well have done.
Yeah, it's a horrible, horrible feature, which I think the gambling industry, for the most part, know benefits them greatly and does a huge amount of damage to, let's be honest here, the substantial portion of people with severe gambling problems who prop up the gambling industry profit base. Realistically, let's, you know, if we call a spade a spade. And that thing, like, you know, if you're lodging money onto an online gambling account, miraculously, that does not take 3 days. It does not take three business days to lodge money onto an online gambling account. But when you're taking it out, for some reason that is beyond my limited comprehension, it can take up to 3 business days, unless, of course, you change your mind and you reverse that withdrawal. I mean, it's just, it's wrong on every level. They know it.
It's totally wrong, isn't it? It's totally wrong. And, you know, like you say, you can put your money in and they don't care who you are. But to take your money out, it'll be 3 days. But that's not the first time, probably, because at that point, you've got to send them your passport. You've got to send them some letters about where you live. You've got to send them your mum's previous bloody name. If, you know what I mean? Like, they'll ask for anything they can to not give you that money. And that's one of the things that we talk about. I know, like, obviously, All Bets Are Off is a gambling recovery podcast, but it's an addiction recovery podcast, but also part of what we say is, you know, there is going to be an industry going forward. We're not here to say there shouldn't be. We're here to help those who've struggled with it. But, you know, for those who do use it, at least make it fair. It should be fair for those who can. That's a really important thing.
Yeah, we're going to come on to that because you guys are chairing the Sustainable Gambling Conference shortly. That's next week. Before, and I know Tony's a little bit stuck for time. So, Tony, do you want to come in there? Any thoughts or questions for Chris?
No, just to kind of go back to the analogy with the boxing, I think it's brilliant. And I think, like, even listening to your story, it's kind of like, you know, again, it was like I was at the Gambling with Lives launch yesterday in the north, and just listening to, you know, Philip McGuigan was speaking, and it was good. A couple of people, James Graham, I got to meet James yesterday, which was absolutely amazing. And just listening to people talking about the recovery, talking about how they've come out the far side, it kind of really, I suppose maybe it's just probably, it really kind of hit me yesterday. I suppose when you're hearing about people who've taken their own lives, it does, as we were saying off camera, it really does resonate a lot more, because I've been in that position. You've been in that position. Ryan was saying he's been in a position where you kind of really are seriously contemplating this as a way to stop this absolute sledgehammering in your own mind. So it really is lovely to, like, connect with like-minded people to kind of really get a sense, really kind of feel that you're not alone with that. And that's why we were saying about the gambling recovery community is so important. And I know Barry was saying that we don't have as many people in Ireland maybe on Twitter talking about it, but it's so, it goes across the borders anyway, because everyone, once you go into recovery, same in GA meetings, people wrap their arms around you and try to help you in any way you can. And even just listening to stories like yourself, like Ryan's, just really, it really kind of, I'm left with a sense of actually pride of how far I've come, and sense of pride that we can come out the far side of this, and we can in some way, probably are helping some people by doing the podcast. Like, I had someone contact me the other day saying he was 50 days free of gambling, saying that the podcast has been the one thing constant in his life that's really, really helped him, just hearing other people share their experiences. Like, even listening to Stacey last week, picking up bits that she was saying, like, there's a huge amount of learning in that for me and Barry, but also just, there's a huge amount of connection. And I think it was, you know all the kind of ins and outs, Barry, all the, you're the intelligent one of the two of us. Someone said that connection is the opposite of addiction. Who says Harry, is it? Or
Johan Harry, yeah.
I always remember one name, because I'm terrible with names. So it's kind of that, is that, like, it is like if connection is what we can do by the podcasts, by DMing people, by talking to people, by opening up ourselves to being able to talk about this very openly, and we can get that connection, then we have a great chance of not slipping back into addiction or helping people who are in the early stages of recovery from that addiction as well. So again, it's just great to listen to the two stories and to be able to that really resonates. So it's brilliant.
Yeah, and I think what you just said there, Tony, is fantastic and absolutely true. And something that me and Ryan said on the last episode of season 4 was the fact that when we say, you know, please do reach out to us, please do. We want you to, because actually we get a great deal of kind of pride, and also it helps our recovery, to be honest. And, you know, we are here to try and help one person. That's why we started this. To hear that it is amazing. And I think, as Barry might have mentioned earlier as well, you know, we know that people come and listen to us at the start of their recovery as maybe a way in to phone in a helpline or get into a meeting. I think it's really lovely that we've got these podcasts now that act as that kind of bridge into recovery, which maybe wasn't there when I was looking to get into recovery. Some people will listen in the long term. Some people will come back and dip in every now and again. But the fact that some people might just come listen to one episode and think, oh, I'm not alone, I'll give this helpline a call, or I'll go to this meeting, I think that's absolutely amazing. So I love what we do, and I love what you guys do, because I know you guys started about the same time as us. I was listening to you guys thinking, cool, they're good. Really like them. Hope we're all right.
You guys are great. And like, you definitely did it inspired what we were doing, because I'd never crossed my mind. I studied sound engineering for a year, and I always wanted, my dream when I was a teenager was to be a radio DJ playing indie rock or whatever. And then that just kind of drifted into other things. But I've had an interest in kind of filmmaking and kind of techie stuff. So, you know, it kind of seemed natural enough, but it hadn't occurred to me as an idea until I saw what you guys are doing. And okay, this is a thing. It could be a thing. We're in this weird lockdown space. Everybody's stuck at home, stuck in front of a screen. Is this a way, you know, that we can reach out to people, not knowing that it could be a bridge? And you described it perfectly, Chris, there. There's so many people, like, I think it's between 1-2% of the people who access our website, say every year, will pick up the phone and contact us on the helpline, or send an email, or send a text, right? So that's a tiny, tiny percentage of all the people, however many tens of thousands, that will access our website every year. The rest of the people are getting some sort of self-help information. One of the most popular pages on our website is actually the apps. Yeah, so people are looking for information on Kanban or RecoverMe or other apps that they can use, because they want to do it the self-help way. Now, some people will try that self-help way and it'll work for them. For others, they will need additional supports. But to have something where you can go for a walk, you can stick on the headphones, go walk the dogs, and you can listen to somebody like yourselves or any of the great guests that we've had on, any of the great guests that you guys have had on, and go, oh yeah, I relate to that. That person, it's like they're reading my mind. I've had those exact same thoughts. I've engaged in those exact same behaviors. I'm not nuts, right? Or at least I'm not the only person who is this type of nuts, right? And then, you know, maybe that attracts them to go into like a group meeting if it's GA, Smart Recovery, or if they're going for one-to-one supports, whatever it might be. And then you're in a room full of people who are all saying the exact same things that you've thought and done. You go, okay, lots of other people feel this way. And then it normalizes it, right? And whether if it's gambling, alcohol, anxiety, depression, anything, ADHD, whatever it is, just to know, okay, I'm not the only person who thinks, feels and behaves this way. Okay, that takes a load off for most people. Before we kind of let you guys go today, there was that really important thing that we wanted to talk to you about, which is the Sustainable Gambling Conference, which is coming up. Ryan, you've been super patient there. The good thing about podcasting is it turns you into a good listener. So, I mean, you guys are masters at it at this stage. Do you want to start off telling us a little bit about what that is? I mean, we've touched on it, I think, a little bit already. I mean, gambling is something that's always going to exist. Prohibition of gambling is nobody's looking for that. I know there are certain people in the gambling industry who like to call people on this side of the street prohibitionists. I've certainly never called for the prohibition of gambling or alcohol or anything else, really, because it doesn't work. It's never worked. It drives people into a black market run by, you know, it's pretty dodgy criminals. Nobody's calling for prohibition. It's a terrible idea. It doesn't work, right? So if we're going to have legalized gambling across the world, which we are going to have in most places, how do we make it as fair and balanced and sustainable as possible? Is that what this conference is looking
at? Yes, essentially. So basically, Chris and I have been invited to moderate a session with certain guests from the industry. You know, they range from, you know, the CEO of Kindred Group, payment providers, investment groups, a psychologist that I think is on there as well, news media, Bridget Simmons, the chairman of the Betting and Gaming Council. Using Chris's analogy of boxing, it could be very entertaining on that part. But we're there to sort of, you know, we sent an introductory email to the panel earlier on in the week, and you know, similar to what you were saying, Barry, you know, we pointed out, you know, we're not anti-gambling, we're not prohibitionist. You know, I think a lot of the lived experience community probably look into it, and it's a case of what are you doing? You know, you're just patting yourselves on the backs and such like that. We're basically there to try and hold them to account and to ask questions that we want to ask. So around the importance of building trust and managing the issue of gambling responsibility. And also we're going to be talking about, you know, gambling advertising and responsible gambling advertising. And we've essentially created a set of questions for the two panels that we'll be moderating. It's been split into two groups, and it allows us to ask the questions that matter to us and I know other sections of the lived experience community. So yeah, it's a wonderful opportunity. And I think that they were really, they wanted us to get us on because they know that we're going to, you know, we're not going to sort of, you know, plod around topics. You know, we're really going to be asking them some hard-hitting questions, some questions that they're going to have to really think about. And it's, you know, without us being there, you know, and I put this into my email, in fact, the publication that's going to go up onto onto the official website, I do believe, you know, I said that we are there to hold them to account, and we are there to ask the sinister questions, you know. So yeah, we're really looking forward to it. I don't know whether Chris has got anything to add on to that.
Chris, any thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, firstly, Ryan has kind of hit it on the head what we're there for. We're there because we believe that things haven't been done properly. We know they haven't been done properly. We know there's going to be an industry in the future. So how do we get it right? And for me, that's important to talk to not just the industry, but those around the industry as well. So, you know, I hear a lot now that talk about dual accountability. So, you know, everything at the moment is put upon the gambler. So the talk of responsible gambling, that's all putting everything onto the gambler. You set your own limits, you self-exclude, all this stuff. And then there's nothing on the gambling side there, but there must be, there needs to be. But I think it's wider than that. And it isn't just about dual accountability. It's about accountability of others around as well. So the other kind of guests we're going to have here, so payment providers, banks, all that kind of stuff. How do people ensure that gambling is harm-free? That's what I want to get to. I want there to be a gambling industry out there, because there will be. Prohibition doesn't work, but it needs to be harm-free. And I want these people to tell me, I agree with that. Now, they may or may not say that. And in fact, I don't think they will say that to me on the day. Of course they won't. But that's what I want to get to, a harm-free industry, which means people who want to gamble and can gamble, then go down the horses and have a few quid on a horse, because, you know, that's historically what you do at horse racing, and that's fine, can do that. But those who can't, like me, like Ryan, like Tony, who we're talking to a minute ago, I know he's had to run off, we shouldn't be able to be harmed, you know, not when they produce addictive products. Not when they produce products and they cross-sell the more addictive ones to us. Not when they spend all this money on gambling to get people like us to bet and, you know, take 60% of their profits from 5% of people like me and Ryan. So what I want is a safe industry that is set up in the right way, has the right business models. Their business model doesn't currently work. They're taking money from people who are essentially being harmed a lot of the time. And as we know, that can end in ending people taking their own lives or ending in prison, all this kind of stuff. That's not right. That is not an industry that is good for anybody other than maybe a few people at the top who are taking their profits. So yeah, for me, that's what this is about. It's about hearing what they're going to say, asking them, what are those steps? How are you going to get to nearer where I want you to be, which is a totally harm-free, sustainable industry?
It's about what concessions they need to make the industry more sustainable. Obviously we've seen a mass growth of the gambling industry over the past number of years. And, you know, without us being there is, you know, I suspect that it would be sort of kind of like rolling around laughing, patting each other on the back and whatnot. So to have those open and honest conversations from people that have experienced harm and put in difficult questions to them, you know, we just want them to be held to account. And yeah, as Chris says, figure out a way where it's safer, fairer and more sustainable.
Yeah, and I think it's great that you have, say, the payment providers, banks, credit card companies, whoever else in there, because certainly in the UK, there's much more progress around this than there is in Ireland currently, that many of the banks will give an option to turn off gambling transactions with a cooling off period, you know, for a change of mind, but, you know, hugely beneficial. Not a bulletproof system, but as most people would know, most impulses or most relapses are impulse driven, so it's in the moment. You don't want to wait 3 days, right? For that's certainly, you know, so having a cooling off period, it goes a long way. It's not a perfect system, but it does go a long way. And that would be a huge one. I suppose, you know, the movement towards conversation on dual accountability is important, although it leaves out one other extremely important player, which is the government. Right. And there's a theory that it really we need three-way responsibility, where you'd have responsible policy at government level, responsible provision at the level of the operator, and then responsible consumption from the consumer. You know, and if you leave out the government and don't have rules, regulations, laws robust and strictly enforced, well then, you know, we're talking about codes of practices, and codes of practices, forget about it. Like, that's too much money to be too much money at play here for people to be looking at codes of practices. So I would throw in the government, their robust legislation and regulation. I think that is probably an important part of it, but it's great to hear that you're doing that, and somebody needs to do it. And I suppose fair play to the gambling operators for doing it, because I mean, I've been doing this, I think I set up what was originally Problem Gambling Ireland before we merged with Extern a couple of years ago in 2016. And I've done, because there are so few people who talk about gambling in the Irish media, almost from day one, I've been doing a lot of media interviews, and I'm happy to be openly critical of the gambling industry because we've never taken funding from them. So I can just take what I believe to be an ethical standpoint on it. I'm sure I have my own biases, but I've done, God, it could be 100 of those interviews, maybe more at this stage. There's never, ever been somebody from the gambling industry on the other side. They just, they'll send out a statement. They never, ever put up anybody against you because they know they're on a pretty sticky wicket. Right? So in fairness to them, like, from the show up and say, okay, well, let's answer some questions. You know, I don't want to preempt what that might look like, but, you know, from the show up, and especially somebody from the Betting and Gaming Council, and to have that conversation, like, that needs to happen, right? It can't be us versus them, because they control the industry, right? So like, if there's not buy-in from them, you know, if you're in any negotiation, it has to come, your end result has to be some version of a win-win. It can't be,
I wanted to add in there, Barry, I don't think it was a case of, and maybe I've miscommunicated this, I don't think it was a case of them knowing or wanting us to be there. We sort of kind of got an invite through the back door, and this is why we've left it late in the day to make that announcement and introductions to the panel of guests, because then it would look a little bit sort of kind of like, hang on a minute, it looks a bit bad if they were to pull out. So what you were saying there, Barry, no credit should go to a bunch of those panelists at all. We've been facilitated by an insider, let's say. But you are right, these conversations should be happening, and hopefully this experience will allow other debates to happen, whether it be bringing other people from the lived experience side of things, and there'd be a willingness to partake in these sorts of discussions. And I think that's the key thing. You know, we're not there to, you know, critique and lambast per se, but these discussions do need to happen. So yeah, just wanted to point that out there.
Yeah, I suppose that's an important distinction. But look, however you get them to the table, you know, is probably less important than the fact that they get to the table in the first place. And like, as Chris said, I suppose this is the big one, because many of these are publicly listed companies and they have shareholders and all that sort of stuff, that realistically, they're going to have to take a cut in profits. Like, there's no other way of approaching this unless they convince every human with a pulse on planet Earth to gamble moderately, you know, just to kind of keep the baseline figures right. They're going to have to, if the goal is achieved and you minimize or eliminate harm, I think eliminating is a great aspiration, although I'm not sure how realistic that would be, but I think it's a great aspiration and a goal to aim for, but certainly to minimize it radically, it's going to inevitably result in a massive loss in profits, right? If they actually start making meaningful interventions, it can only result in a massive loss in profits. most humans don't want to do that, right? Whatever, whether it's your household budget or it's your business or whatever it is, and if you have shareholders to answer to. So in some ways, it can be a tough sell. But I think there are operators out there who are willing to say, well, look, okay, we've made our money here. We're turning, as Sir Kenny said recently on Irish TV, the gambling industry is turning into big tobacco at this stage. There's so much negative sentiment towards the gambling industry. I think the smart people in the room there will know which way the wind is blowing and will say, well, look, we're going to have to make an adjustment here, or else, you know, things are going to be imposed upon them that they don't want to have imposed upon them. So I think hopefully common sense will prevail there. But of course, you're up against the good old fashioned greed is good.
Absolutely.
Mindset as well.
Yeah. And I think the other thing you just said there as well, Barry, about, you know, you mentioned about legislation and that is so important, legislation and regulation. And I think you mentioned much earlier in the show, actually, about the fact that, you know, some of the gambling industry realize this, they'll realize it, but some of them decide that they might make some moves now to, you know, to hopefully minimize what comes out of our review in the UK at the moment. And, you know, hopefully they'll, you know, they'll get a lighter touch with regards to legislation. So, you know, the more they can make themselves look good now, the better. But we need to make sure that it isn't just that they've made a few steps that minimize harm a little bit or makes them look better. You know, it's got to be real, it's got to be true. And, you know, legislation is important as well. So, you know, I do hope those who are going to review all the Gambling Act stuff, put the white paper out and actually make the new law as such, take all this into account and, you know, really, really consider the public health side of things here. The loss of lives, you know, this is also important. Yes, people can make money, people can be greedy, but some poor families lose loved ones through this, and, you know, that needs to be eliminated for me.
Absolutely. Look, you know, I couldn't agree with you more, and Tony, who had to jump off early, could not agree with you more. I suppose it's just trying to strike that balance between some people, you know, gambling is going to exist. So a certain amount of people view it as a form of entertainment and do it moderately. Fair play to those people and, you know, wish them all well. The gambling industry has a right to make money. Sure, it's a legal industry as well. And to strike that balance between, okay, you can do that, but you cannot knowingly destroy people's lives, right? I mean, I've had the benefit of doing a bit of consultancy work for a company that makes artificial intelligence systems that scan players' profiles in online gambling systems, right? So I've been able to see inside the machine a little bit, and you can look at somebody's gambling profile, let's say you get a 3-month window, and go, holy mother of God, this person went on a 72-hour gambling spree where they didn't even sleep. Like, you know, the gambling industry have this data at their fingertips. Nobody knows more about this than the online gambling companies, right? They can see it, they can flag it, they can automate the systems to flag it. They can then use those automations to trigger a human intervention or a mandated or an automated intervention. They have all this stuff at their fingertips. They're already looking at it. And it's as clear as the nose in your face who has a severe gambling problem from those individual player profiles and who does not, right?
This is one of the questions that we're actually asking them, Barry. It's a fair cop there. It's one of the questions that I put together to talk about data sets provided by both industry, especially industry payment providers, and so forth, and whether, you know, weaponizing telephone surveys based on 4,000 people as a representative sample by certain industry bodies and such is really useful, where critically, as you say, is unfortunately what with the industry the way it is, you know, it's money going in and out, and the core data is held by the industry, and we can't help but feel that that would be the best place to obtain this data, to really sort of kind of like put a more congealed picture together of problematic gambling, the harms, people that are at risk, etc., as opposed to, as I say, as 4,000 people on a telephone in within a subject area that is obviously we're looking to change this, but steeped in stigma historically, yeah. You know?
Sorry, you're referring to prevalence studies there, Ryan, just to clarify.
In terms of prevalence studies, but in terms of also harm reduction as well. As you say, it's clear as your nose on your face, you know, and they need to be using that data set for a bunch of reasons, obviously harm reduction being the core one, but also to understand the problem, the level of the problem, so that we can actually do something about it.
Yeah, and I know that the only regulate, because we don't have a gambling regulator in Ireland, but the National Lottery here does have one. They're in the same building as the National Lottery. I think the National Lottery of 100 staff, something like that. The regulator is about 10 staff. And the regulator has a live feed of the lottery's online system that they can dip into the data anytime they want, right? In an ideal world, the gambling regulators of the world will be able to say, well, I'm going to tap into, I'm going to take a random data set from Paddy Power, Bet365, from all the major online operators, randomly selected, and go, okay, that's 100 people. You know, let's have a look at how many of them are gambling in a way that is clearly problematic or disordered or addicted or whatever. And that's kind of a little bit of the work that I've been doing with this AI service as well. And when you get those random data sets, like, it's mind-blowing. Like, it's absolutely mind-blowing. When you see the sort of stuff that people are doing online, the amount of time, the amount of money, you know, spiraling. You could, just from a data set, you can see a human being spiraling out of control. And, or else, you know, gambling, you know, payday, going on mad gambling binges, then the next month or the next week when payday rolls around, gambling binges. Like, all this stuff the gambling industry have at their fingertips, it would be much better off in the hands of the NHS or the gambling regulator or other independent researchers like that. I think that's, you know, something
totally
worth teasing out.
Totally, Barry. And one of the things I'd just say there as well, when you've got all that info, you can design different tools. So currently the tools are, you come in as a player and you set your time limit. You come in as a player and you self-exclude. You come in as a player and you do this or that. If you've got that data, you can say, oh, this player gets paid on this particular day. All right, we're going to let them play with us, but we're going to tell them you are not allowed to play on this day of the month because we know it's your payday and you chuck all your money in on that day. Do you know what I mean? So there are some things that might be a bad idea because, you know, they can do it the next day, but there is data there which can mean they can design tools which will mean that they can ensure there's safer play rather than ensuring the individual is just being forced to help themselves all the time.
Yeah. Anyway, look, I'm sure we could talk about that until the cows come home. Is the Sustainable Gambling Conference, is that streaming anywhere? Or do people need tickets to that, or how does that work?
Yeah, no, it's streaming online. To be honest, because we should probably be trying to market it a lot better. I would even quote the website if I know it from the top of my head.
I've got it here. So it's the Sustainable Gambling Conference. So that is www.sustainablegambling.com. And if you go on there, you can register. I think it's free to register. And this is taking part on the 5th of October. So there's lots more than just us on there as well. I think we're on at 2:45, our panel, but it's an event that runs from, I think, 1 o'clock until about 5 o'clock or midday till five, something like that.
Brilliant. And if you're listening at some point in the future, long after we're all dead and buried, that was the 5th of October 2021. So listen, I'll put that information up in the episode description as well, and put a link on there, because I think that would be fascinating, and I'll see if I can make time to attend that. Well, listen, guys, you've given so much of your time today, and I know that you've helped so many people with the podcast, and you're doing great work there. And for anyone, any of our listeners who have not yet checked out the All Bets Are Off podcast, please do so, because guys have had so many brilliant discussions on there, so many different topics, so many wonderful guests. Obviously, the guys themselves are brilliant, and they're much better organized than we are at organizing all their topics and all that side of things. So if you're looking for more podcasts to listen to and you have not yet come across the All Bets Are Off podcast, get over there, and they've got tons of stuff, 4 seasons already and season 5 in the pipeline, if I'm correct in thinking.
Indeed. Yeah. Should be within the next month or two. We just need to start recording. But yeah, we've got guests lined up, including Paul Merson as well. So really excited about that one.
Wow, that's a big get. Nicely done. And of course, a former Villa player as well, so it makes it all the better for you, Ryan.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really looking forward to it. Even though he wasn't at the club for long, and it was at the latter part of his career, he still makes my the best 11, funnily enough, that I've seen in a Villa shirt live. So absolutely phenomenal player. I'm really looking forward to that episode.
Well, does Paul McGrath get in there?
He does indeed.
Oh, yes, I'm glad to hear that.
He is there, like... God himself, yeah. No, he makes that 11. He's the first name on the team sheet.
Okay, glad to hear that. Well, listen, guys, thanks so much for taking the time today, and keep doing all the great work that you're doing. And hopefully, we'll keep the conversation going. Ryan Pritchard and Chris Gillam from the All Bets Are Off podcast. Thank you so much. Bye bye. Thank you.